So how deep is the federal debt anyway? And what does it have to do with the way our country will operate from here on out? Find out next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy. Barry Sheets was supposed to be here today, but this being Thanksgiving week, and he being a professional lobbyist, the legislators down at the State House decided at the last minute that they were really going to load him up on some bills that is absolutely necessary for him to be there for. So guess what? Since we have to have this show in early this week, he couldn't be here. So I'm going to do my best to sort of fly this machine in solo. Except I'm not really solo. Because we've been promising you for a couple weeks we were going to try to corner an economist to come in and talk about the things we've been talking about on the last few shows. And so with me here in the studio is a good friend of mine and a good Presbyterian pastor, as I am a good Presbyterian elder. And he is also an economist. He's got a JD. He's been an airline pilot. He's a hockey player, but nowadays he does refereeing. So you may have run into him someplace where he's doing refereeing. Sasha's kind of a renaissance man, and I don't want to embarrass him while he's here. But with me today is Dr. Sasha Volacord, pastor of Knox Presbyterian Church in Mount Vernon, Ohio. We'll give you a little plug there, Sasha, for your church. And like you guys need it. You're growing so fast. Maybe we better hide the lamp under a basket. What do you think?
Well, first of all, good to be with you, Chuck. And it's you can never have enough people in the kingdom. You know, that's what we do. That's what we're supposed to do, to build the kingdom and bring people to Christ. And everybody's welcome to come and join us.
And it, but believe me, folks, it's a great little church. I have there. It's hard to explain if you don't know Presbyterian government, but Knox Presbyterian is under the session of my own church, which is Providence Presbyterian Church in Pataskala, Ohio. You're also welcome to join us there. But I have acted as an elder for Knox Presbyterian because they are a plant of ours, and therefore they're under our session until such time as they become a separate church, which is going to happen, looks like, in when?
December, probably.
Yeah. You're going to be officially made a separate church at the Presbyterian March, but really, strictly speaking, for all practical purposes, it looks like you are a separate church as of December. So I will miss coming up, but we won't always miss coming up because I'm sure we'll visit from time to time. Our sessions are friendly, and we're always happy to go up and pay a visit. And I do currently, Barry and I just completed a class in Mount Vernon at what is called Knox Academy, which is an outreach of
Knox Presbyterian Church.
That's right. And what Barry and I taught was a Constitution class, our Institute on the Constitution class. We just completed 12 weeks, and it was a great homeschool group. I love personally, you know, I love teaching this class, Sasha. But one of the things I always do when I teach an adult class is I look around the room and I say, okay, please kind of mentally take the average age of everyone in this room. And unfortunately, it's always around 50. when I do that with your Knox Academy classes, it's always very nice to see it's more like 20. When you add in all the oldsters who are in the who are teaching and in the class, it's closer to 20, which always makes my heart feel much better. Folks out there in your 20s and 30s, you need to come out and learn how your government works. So you have your opportunity coming up in Westerville. We're teaching a class starting January. Hang on, I'll get the exact dates up for you because I have it right here. January 16th, 2014 at Grace Fellowship Church, 3475 Paris Boulevard in Westerville. Finally, I don't have to drive 40 miles to teach a class. I get to drive 4 miles to teach a class. Believe me, that's a real boon as far as I'm concerned. But you'll get a chance to do what Sasha's Knox Academy students just got to do, and that is get a 12-week course on the Constitution. And I think, Sasha, you're taking that class.
I will be taking this class. This time I will drive long ways.
There you go. And, well, it's you still live in Pataskala, even though you're going to be moving soon, hopefully.
Yes.
By the grace of God. Mm-hmm. And we look forward to having you in that class. So, and we look forward. Now, Barry and I were bringing these things up because a number of things have come up recently. For instance, on our show last week, and I'm kind of hitting you unprepared with this, but you recover fast. You, being a Renaissance man, you recover awfully fast. We talked about this pre-show a little bit. We had talked about the term the negative deposit rate, and we talked about it not so much to define what a negative deposit rate is, but the fact that the European Union is going to a negative deposit rate. And what it means is that the central bank is no longer going to pay interest to people who put money on deposit with the central bank. When I say people, I mean banks. They're going to charge banks to put money on reserve with the central bank. Now, we explained what we thought the reasons were. What do you think the reasons are?
Well, the banks, of course, the federal banks or the central banks, they want the money to be pumped into the economy, which sounds pretty good when you say it like this, but what it means is there will be more money available for people to go into debt and to buy stuff. What this really means is when people have this money, first of all, people get more and more into debt, but secondly, they buy stuff with it. And when they buy stuff with it, that immediately and in a very short run does increase economic activity. It gives the economy a boost indeed, but it already bears the seed of its own destruction within itself. Because what you're doing with when there's more money than there are goods, you bid up the prices. And that's a result of the invisible hand. That's the economy, how God has created it. And if you put more money, artificially more money, into the hands of people than there should be, it's like on eBay. If you have 10 people bidding on a certain product and they have like $10 each, the maximum price this good will ever reach is $10. Now, double that amount and give people $20. They will bid it up to the maximum amount of $20. And that's what happens to the prices, and that's what we call inflation.
Okay. Now, you use the phrase, the invisible hand. Explain to the folks out there what you mean exactly by the invisible hand. Let's put it in terms that we can understand, because an exact definition of the invisible hand is probably impossible, I would think.
Well, it is. I mean, you can basically explain it with one word, and that is God. At the end of the day, God has created all things, and so he has also created the economy. And so the economy, or all economic dealings, have an inherent logic to themselves. For example, the whole principle of supply and demand. If suddenly a lot of people want the same good, and there's not enough of that good for all of them to buy it, what will happen is they will bid up the price. So the one person who is willing and ready to give up most for this good gets it. And that's the invisible hand. If that wouldn't be the case, we would have chaos. But so we have order in the economic system. And all economic dealings, all economic actions have consequences. And at the end of the day, the economy is laid out by God to equalize itself in a certain respect. So for example, if governments produce more money than there is actually value, if I may say it in these words, and they artificially pump money into the economy, like creating money out of thin air, playing God. You know, that's what governments try. They want to be like God, creating something out of nothing. God says, no, you cannot do that, because when you do it, you will pay afterwards for it with inflation. So that's the invisible hand at the end of the day, wrestling down everybody who wants to tamper with God's economic order.
So essentially, what's going on with governments is that they are artificially pumping what they call money. Really, what they're doing is creating credit.
Yeah, they're changing numbers. They're not even bothering to print it anymore.
So that takes your eBay example and says, well, so-and-so might have more access instead of having the $20 maximum. They're pumping money in, so he suddenly has $40. Mm-hmm. So one person or maybe two people, because for some reason they might be a better risk. They might understand the rules a little better. They might have some kind of favoritism.
Or they're closer to government.
Or they're closer to government. They're closer to the source of the artificially created wealth.
Yes, the humanistic god, government.
Okay. How long have we been in this kind of situation, strictly speaking?
Well, I would say, in the long run, since the fall.
Yeah, okay.
Because that's when all lying came and all false weights and measures. But strictly spoken, in the United States, I would say we really got into this mess with the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, put into practice in 1914. That's when it all started, when federal banking started, and the government began to create money out of thin air.
Okay. Now, you probably aren't very familiar with this history, but I know that there have been attempts since the beginning of the Republic, and actually before, to create central banking. There was the first Bank of the United States, the second Bank of the United States, and we had the same problem.
But President Jackson at some point defeated this first federal bank of the United States. He said he was a monster.
That was actually, I believe, the second bank.
The second. Killed
the second bank. The first bank, it's interesting to see the players, and we won't go too much into this, but we had the same problem, believe it or not, during the Revolution. We couldn't pay all the bills to buy the gunpowder and pay the soldiers and feed them and everything. So a guy by the name of Robert Morris came up with a plan where he created a quasi-national bank called the Bank of North America. And what he did was this is a very interesting story, and you can read about it in Forrest McDonald's E Pluribus Unum, I believe. I have a copy of it here up here on the shelf someplace in the library. But what he basically did was he created this bank, got people to subscribe to it. And by subscribe, I mean sold stock, put money on deposit. And he asked people to put the money on deposit and to actually only do business through the Bank of North America. And he took $400,000 and made it look like $4 million. And it worked really well until everybody asked for their money back.
But that sounds like a Ponzi scheme, doesn't it?
Oh, gosh, it sure does. Yeah, explain what a Ponzi scheme is.
Well, a Ponzi scheme is you promise something to people, you know, when you run into people like Bernie Madoff and they promise you a high return rate on your money and they guarantee it to you, and all they do is they take your money and then they try to convince more people to buy their stuff, and they take the money from the second round of people and pay the first round of people off. And as you can imagine, this inverse pyramid goes, you know, broader and broader on top until the point when you cannot satisfy your creditors anymore. And that's when the whole thing collapses, and the federal banking system or the central banking system does just that. It keeps promising people. It lives in the future, and every politician hopes and prays that the check's not going to bounce on his watch. And that's how this whole Federal Reserve system is a Ponzi scheme.
One of the reasons that we brought this up, there is an attempt out there to do a balanced budget amendment. And one thing that Barry was researching when he was preparing his testimony before the House Policy and Government Oversight Committee was he came across this an article written by a professor Kotlikoff from
Boston University.
Boston University, in which Kotlikoff. Now we have all heard the numbers about what the debt is. That we're currently $16 or $17 trillion in debt, and the unfunded mandate debt is really closer to $47 trillion. What does Kotlikoff say?
Well, Kotlikoff says that the real debt, and that includes Social Security, because the government for the last decades has heavily taken money out of the Social Security Trust Fund and Medicare and federal pensions. So the real amount of unfunded federal liabilities for the year 2013 is, now you better fasten your seatbelts, is $205 trillion.
$205 trillion. That is 205 followed by 12 zeros. Is that right?
A 10 to the 12th power.
Yeah. 200 followed by 12 zeros. So it's two times, it's basically 2 times 10 to the 14th power of dollars. Folks, if you look at that kind of money in cash in 20s. If I'm not mistaken, the visual picture is, I think it circles the moon and comes back.
Oh, yeah.
Stacked one on top of another, not end-to-end. it's a huge amount of money. It's an unbelievable, and honestly, it's an unmanageable amount of money. What's going to happen if... What are the consequences if that number is correct?
Well, if that number is correct, and I do believe it is correct, then at this point it doesn't really matter if it's 205, even if it's 100 trillion. It doesn't make a difference because the outcome will always be the same, and that it will be default.
What does default mean?
Default means that the government will be unable to pay its obligation. You know, the government checks at some point will bounce, and, you know, pensioners will not get their pensions, federal pensioners. The government cannot pay back its debt. Social Security payments cannot be met. Medicare cannot be met. And the government simply has no more means. At the same time, you will have high inflation. And inflation, to an extent, could become even runaway inflation, and the whole currency could collapse. Although that's not for sure if we see a collapse, because the government doesn't basically want, of course, a collapse of the dollar, because they have too much long-term debt through Social Security and through Medicare and through federal pensions. So they cannot pay it off early with cheap money, because usually an inflation only takes two or three, or a crash of a currency that usually takes 2 or 3 years, then a new currency comes up, and the government still has to meet its obligations with the new currency. So it's not very tempting for a government to crash the currency, but the unintended consequence will be inflation, because all they can do right now is produce more numbers, more money, and that will bid up the prices and will make the economy worse and worse and worse. How far that goes, we don't know. I mean, you could make a scenario and say politicians really don't care about the crash because they hope that the crash will come long after they're out of office, so they keep printing money. So there would be an argument for the total abandonment of the U.S. dollar. But the one thing is clear. The situation in America is that America is bankrupt. We just don't know it yet.
What are the signs?
Well, the signs we definitely see. You know, all that upholds this economy, if you can even call it that, is the religious belief in monopoly money, in paper. It's just because people believe that $100 buys a certain amount of goods, that's why we still spend them and get goods for $100. But when people catch up how the real situation of the dollar is, then people will move out of money, move out of currency. They will buy gold. They will buy property. They want to get away from the dollar. They will abandon money. They will abandon the dollar. And that's when it probably is unsalvageable anymore.
We were talking earlier off air about Kotlikoff's theory. Or his, not theory, but his numbers, because it's not a theory. And you came up with a quote that I know Barry has also used, and that is when he talks about the this bracketed thing you have here on the numbers. Go ahead and give that, and then explain what we're looking at.
Yeah, Kotlikoff explains in layman's terms what would be the taxing and spending consequences of the present value. I mean, he's talking about the debt we already have, the $205 trillion that nobody knows about. All we talk about is the $17 trillion approximately debt that we have budgeted. But the whole debt, including the unfunded liabilities, is $205 trillion. That's what we have at present. That's all the liabilities we know we have. And he tells us what must be done today. He says this: the $205 trillion fiscal gap is enormous. It's 10% of the present value of all future GDP. Equivalently, it corresponds to 10% of GDP year in and year out, for as far as the eye can see. To raise 10% of GDP each year, we could A, raise all federal taxes immediately and permanently by 57%, B, cut all federal spending apart from interest on the debt by 37% immediately and permanently, or C, to some combination of A and B. And that only talks about what we're having now. But, you know, this is increasing year after year instead of decreasing.
Well, let's talk about what that really means. He's talking about debt service.
Yes.
And if people don't understand what that means, put it in terms of your credit card. It's making an interest payment every month on your credit card.
Yeah. You never get off the amount.
And you never get and you never pay any on the principal, yes. ever. It's the same amount at the beginning as it is at the end. Well, there is no end. It is a perpetual motion machine. The amount stays the same.
The end will be default.
Yeah.
And it will have massive, profound consequences. It will have political consequences, economical consequences.
Well, let me ask you a question. If that drastic a measure were to happen, let's say that we do a combination of raising taxes and cutting spending, what does that do to an economy which we have built that relies on people buying stuff?
Well, Kotlikoff is only talking here theoretically because, I mean, another economist says that's about as likely with this administration to cut spending, for example, by 37% is about as likely as winning the lottery three times in a row with only buying one ticket a year. So we're talking theoretically here, okay? Well, if you do the tax increase, that's only theoretical if we have the same turnovers as we have now. But if you increase tax by 57%, the amount of economic incidents will rapidly decrease. And that's what, I don't know, liberals have never understood and will probably never understand because they're too religious to understand it. If you raise taxes, you reduce the number of economic incidents. More taxes means people will say, well, I pay so much tax on what I earn. I pay so much tax on my labor, I'm less and less inclined to work hard. You know, for example, if you're a small business, an entrepreneur, and you say, well, today I pay 20% taxes of everything, and tomorrow I pay 50%. How does that motivate you to work harder? It doesn't. And how many workers will not go to work anymore because they say, as you hear it today in Europe, in Germany, I've heard people in Austria saying, I'm not going to go to work. The transfer payments I receive from the government are higher than what I could ever earn. I work a little bit on the side, apart from the taxes, and I'll be a rich man. So you are disincentivizing hard labor. What I mean is you're disincentivizing people to pursue gaining from their work. And that will move the downward spiral even faster.
Well, I put it this way to people when I'm trying. People will come to me during levy campaigns here, and they'll say to me, "Why are you voting no?" And I said, "Because I can't afford to pay any more taxes on this property. It's only $38 a month for your house. You know, I'll sit there and work the numbers with them. It's only $38 a month." And I said, "Okay, take that and multiply it by." Oh, 8,000 or 9,000 houses in Westerville. And that's assuming that I have an average value house, which is wrong, but we'll go with that assumption. Now, go out into the community. Suddenly, I don't have $38 a month to spend at the hardware store. I don't have it to spend at the restaurant. I don't have it to spend when the kids come by the door looking for me to buy candy bars to fundraise. I don't have $38 to buy gasoline. All these things, and suddenly people wonder why the news tightens and no one's coming. You know, I lost my job because nobody's buying things down at the hardware store. Why can't we seem to put those two things together?
Well, I'll give you an example. During the Reagan administration, what President Reagan did was he almost cut the taxes in half across the board. And the result was that tax revenue increased by almost 100%, which means you cut taxes in half. I'm not saying that it works exactly the same way, right. But we see an economic law here. You decrease the tax burden and people will tax harder. Let me give you one example. If this administration will say today, of course, it will never happen this way with this administration, probably with none.
It's a metaphysical certitude, pretty close that that's not going to happen.
Yeah, you win, you know, three times lottery with one, you know, that's this again. But if the administration would say all American workers will be exempt from taxes for the year 2014, and you hear this for the first time on the news today, ask yourself, how would I react? Well, the first thing I would think about, how can I be as productive as I can? Because in the year 2014, I will be able to make the most back for my work that I've ever made. So I will work hard. But the administration says also, in 2015, we go to the same tax rate as we have now. So what will happen is you will have the best productivity that you have had in this country for 2014. And on December 31st, it will end. And on January 1st, 2015, the productivity will decrease massively and immediately. You still don't understand why lower taxes increase people's incentives to work hard? Well, then I cannot help you.
It's amazing to me. I've always been kind of dumbfounded why people can't see that that $38, first of all, if they come back to you every 3 years and say $38 more, pretty soon, three of those three-year periods, 9 years later, you're at over 100% more, you know, 38, 38, 38, yeah. Except it's not 38 the next time. It's the same percentage increased and the same percentage increase. So you're basically well over $100 more a month, and you keep doing it over and over and over. And you understand. And suddenly you know people are like, well, nobody's coming downtown to go to the restaurant.
When you ask yourself, what do these $38 buy you?
Right,
nothing. At the end of the day, usually it's for schools. You know, and we see what the schools turn out. They increase. They have leveraged year after year after year, and basically they're turning out analphabets. They cannot read and cannot write and are heavily brainwashed towards, inclination towards Marxist philosophy. I'm not going to pay money for that.
And here's the problem. Now we expand it out to the state and the federal level, and basically what does it go for? Well, it goes for, supposedly, it goes for things like everybody looks at the defense part of the budget. And yeah, is that bloated? Yeah, why are we buying tanks when the darn things are sitting there rusting?
Yeah.
Nobody uses tanks in warfare anymore. It's all basically local skirmishing. But let's just say that there is a necessity to buy tanks and airplanes and keep them up. Okay, how many do you need?
That's a good question.
And why do you need bases all over the world to park these airplanes and tanks and all that thing? But that's not even really the bottom line, because what is the percentage of the federal budget is something like 40% defense. What's the rest of it?
Well, 51% is welfare.
Yeah.
And that's basically giving money to people who haven't worked for it. You know? And that's really not by Constitution and not by the Bible. It's not the business of government.
Right. Yeah. Where we were going with this, when we talked about it last week and said we were going to bring you on, is essentially there's a movement out there that if we just pass the balanced budget amendment, if we just require, this is what's fun about this, if we just require the federal government to balance the budget every year, suddenly this problem is going to go away. Is that possible?
No, it's ridiculous for two reasons. First of all, even if we could balance the budget, it wouldn't change a thing about America, because America will still be on a godless way, walking away from the path of righteousness. That's the number one reason. A balanced budget doesn't make a nation Christian. You can have the worst pagan nation and still have a balanced budget. So that's the first reason and the most important one. Our problems lie deeper than the budget. The budget is just a symptom. Secondly, when they talk about the balanced budget, they talk about the year-to-year budget. They talk about basically not adding more to the $17 trillion. But the liabilities in the future remain. The rest to the $205 trillion.
Economists have been talking about this forever, and this is the bulge in the population boom. I'm at basically around the tail end of what was known as the baby boomers. And we all knew that when the baby boomers began to retire, it was going to put a major strain on, first of all, the Social Security system, and then after 1965, the Medicaid system. So are we seeing that now? And what is going to be the effect in the future as they continue to age and...
Yeah, you have less and less people who pay into the system and more people that take out. The problem is that, same as in Europe, the population gets older and older, which basically means you have more and more people who take money out of the system and you have less and less people who pay into it. So you have less and less productive and more, if I may say so, unproductive when it comes to the workforce. That doesn't mean that elderly people are worthless or anything, but they're just in another stage in life where they don't produce this much revenue or this many goods anymore. So in Europe, they have the same system. They're just a few decades ahead, and they have less and less young people. That's, by the way, one of the reasons why they are so pro-immigration. They know their system is about to collapse, and they want to invite more and more people from other countries in, especially Muslim countries where they have many children, and so that these people pay into the system and keep it from collapsing until the current politician's term is over. You know, every politician prays it doesn't happen under his watch. So this is the problem. We're getting older and older. Our system does not encourage people to have children. It basically has now is reaping the fruits of what it has sowed long ago. That, you know, both spouses go to work. They don't have many children, and so the population gets older and older and older. And who's going to pay for them? You know, you have less and less young people paying for more and more older people, and that's a Ponzi scheme. To come back to what we had first, and it's going to collapse.
That brings me to a point that you made earlier, and that is that basically we've been stealing from the Medicaid fund, the Social Security fund. When I say stealing, it's all federal money, but supposedly those are quote-unquote trust funds.
Yeah, that's a joke.
Explain.
Well, it's a trust fund because, you know, there should be some trust. You know, there should be some honorability in it, that the money stays in it and collects, you know, it increases so we can cash in on the promises that have been made in the past. Instead, the government uses those trust funds and borrows heavily against them, putting IOUs in, and so basically the Social Security trust fund is empty because the government takes money out of it like there's no tomorrows, literally. But now are all these liabilities, and that's a big chunk of this $205 trillion. And these liabilities don't show up anywhere in the budget. So that's how they come up with a $17 trillion deficit. They only talk about the official budgets.
Now, it's interesting you bring that up because in our current governor, and you probably really don't have any way of knowing this, but when he was in Congress, served on Finance Committee, and is credited with, quote-unquote, balancing the budget during the Clinton administration, and even the chairman of the House Policy and Government Oversight Committee made this point when someone talked about how the federal budget had been balanced through all 8 years of the Clinton administration. And he pointed out, he said, ma'am, the Clinton administration budget was balanced during 2 years, and it was never really balanced.
It was an accounting trick.
It was an accounting trick, and I'll be quite honest, guess who was in charge of the accounting trick? Governor John Kasich. And he just did it again. He did it when he filled a $8 billion hole in Ohio's budget by basically kicking expenses down the road and also borrowing money that from pension funds and that kind of thing. And this is exactly what he did when he was in Congress. And so we shouldn't be shocked. Now, this is a man who has come out in favor of a balanced budget amendment. At the same time, he has just come up and taken money for Medicaid expansion, which is going to take the bogus number of $17 trillion and turn it into $23 trillion, not just for Ohio. If all the states that are lined up to take Medicaid expansion money take it, it's going to cost another $6 trillion. That's just up front. That's not counting the hidden things that we've just all been talking about. So tell me, what would you call it when you've got a guy who basically uses sleight of hand to fill budget holes, kicks the can down the road, and essentially makes it so, I mean, we all know by the time this really hits hard, John Kasich's going to be retired living in Arizona.
Exactly.
On his pension fund.
Yes, and it's, you call it again what it is, it's a Ponzi scheme. And I was remiss, I need to point out that this sleight of hand, this Ponzi scheme, this hiding of the main liabilities of our deficit of $205 trillion is a bipartisan effort. This is not something that the Democrats have done, and we need to be very clear about this. This is about where the two parties are most united in, you know, tricking the American people with a central banking system. The institution of a central bank, as well as the final abolition of the gold standard, was a bipartisan effort. It's not a Democrat. It's not Obama's fault. It's not Bush's fault. It was bipartisan.
And it has been throughout history. A lot of people don't understand that. For instance, you know, people will come out and talk about the founding fathers and these wonderful things that they did. Well, one person who was almost directly responsible for the first bank in the United States was Alexander Hamilton, who some people look upon as a hero. Personally, in my book, he's a goat. People always point me to Ron Chernow's book on Alexander Hamilton. And honestly, if you look up here on my library shelf, and if you look right about, the middle of the shelf, there's a yellow book with Alexander Hamilton's picture on the outside spine there, right next to America's History tape set. And you'll see that I've read that book, and it's a hagiography. For the folks out there who don't know what a hagiography is essentially a sainthood biography. In other words, Alexander Hamilton never did anything wrong. He's this American saint of the great American civic religion, and we really can't speak ill of him. And I've actually run into that. But the fact is, he's responsible for the first bank of the United States, and he and James Madison had been great allies right up until the first bank of the United States, and Madison was adamantly opposed to the first bank of the United States. Until he got into the presidency and got us embroiled in the War of 1812. And once he had us embroiled in the War of 1812, he was trying to pay for the War of 1812 and discovered that because there wasn't a Bank of the United States, there wasn't all this credit. There wasn't all this money that could be inflated. Because all the money, creation of currency, was in the hands of state and local banks, who only created currency on the basis of how much money they had on deposit. You couldn't oversubscribe. You could. People, they did it, and they almost always got caught, and usually they went to jail.
Well, money printing was always interesting during wars, and America has done it during every single war.
Well, there's a phrase, not worth a continental.
Exactly. And it was during the Vietnam War, it was during the Civil War, it was during World War One, World War Two. That's how politicians get their money. Because the only two other possibilities are you can raise taxes or you can borrow as a government. You know, borrowing means you have to pay back immediately, and raising taxes might cause a taxpayer revolution. So the elegant way, as they think, is just to print more money and then call inflation like an economic reality that you cannot avoid anyway. Or, you know, calling it inflation it basically means you have expanded monetary supply artificially. But they make it sound like greedy business people have raised their prices because they woke up and felt greedy on a certain day. But inflation is a necessary consequence of increasing monetary supply. And tell me which university you want to go today in an economics class where they're going to tell you that. This is one of the best-kept secrets.
Well, they used to get that at wherever you used to teach.
Yeah.
Well, I may have not have reiterated it enough, but you have a PhD in economics, and you have taught recently at local universities, Ohio Christian. You've taught at, Franklin?
Yes, and the Nazarene University in
Mount Vernon. Mount Vernon Nazarene.
But you don't get very far with the views that I hold, you know, against false weights and measures. You know, you don't get to Harvard, you don't get to Princeton with those views, you know, because that's there's a class of economists that are heavily connected and breastfed by the government and get their grants from the government. They will not bite the hand that feeds them. And ideologically, most of them are on the liberal side. I mean, we call it liberal, but there's nothing liberal about it. It's a tyrannical side where the government runs everything, including monetary supply. Who says that government has to run the money? Money, usually, when we look at the history of money, money pops up spontaneously where people are, even in prison camps. You know, we have the famous examples that, you know, cigarettes being used as money or chewing gum or chocolate. Who says that the government has to run monetary supply? We got very well along without government. It's just we are indoctrinated with the idea if government doesn't run something, it's not going to run.
It's interesting you bring that up because somebody reminded me of a book I read years ago, years and years and years ago. And it was about a prisoner of war camp, I think in Burma or somewhere in that theater of the war during World War II. And it was this prisoner of war camp, and there was a guy who basically got what you could call rich there by coming up with a way to feed the prisoners, and he would charge them to feed him. So he always had cigarettes, he always had candy, he always had chewing gum, he had crisp uniform, and he had guys who would repair his uniforms, and it was always pressed and all this other stuff. This book is called King Rat. Many people will recognize the author James Clavell, who wrote Shogun. And at the end, people find out that they have no idea he's made a deal with someone to raise these creatures that they eat. And the fact is, at the end, they all find out that he's been feeding them raised rats. He raised these rats and fattened them up and killed them and provided these rats for these guys to eat in exchange for all these goods. Well, at the end, he didn't fare very well because the powers that be don't like people who create their own currency. So what happens if you try to go off books when you've got a federal monopoly on money creation? What happens when you try to go off books?
Well, first of all, the thing that troubles me most is that we have lost the intellectual or philosophical idea of freedom. When we think of freedom, we mean basically, I mean, I can go on vacation where I want. Freedom is, you know, I can buy the good that I want in a supermarket. But step by step, if you look at the history, for example, of this country, but we don't have to only stay here. It's worldwide. Governments have the tendency to be tyrannical if they're non-Christian governments because they're not accountable to God. So they decrease the freedom of the people. And every generation grows up with less freedom. And if you grow up in a system, it's like, you know, the frog in the boiling water. You know, it gets warmer slowly, and you don't realize it until you're burned in it. So that's the most troubling thing, that people are so well adapted to the idea that government basically runs everything now. You know, I saw on the news a few days ago, there was a commercial of a healthcare provider, and it says, our healthcare plans are all government approved. And it made me sick to my stomach, you know. Here's the government supposed to serve us, supposed to be under the word of God, accountable to God, telling us what healthcare plan they have approved for us. And you talk about rats. How different are we from the rats in the lab right now? How have we lost the idea of freedom and becoming complacent with this kind of tyranny that we're facing now? And for me as a European, this is deeply saddening. I came to this country, I've seen it all in Europe, and I come to this country, I loved America always for the freedom. And I come here, and it's the same tyranny, just worse.
Explain that.
You know, in Europe, I can at least cross the street where I want to. In America, you even have a law for jaywalking, you know. And it's just a little example. It seems like everything is regulated. Everything is regulated. And you can get to prison for nothing. I mean, tell a European that in America you can be imprisoned for speeding. They won't believe it. I've tried it. They won't believe it, you know. And the way how government speaks with you, talks with you, you feel like a lab rat, and this is coming from a European.
Yeah, well, we are definitely creating, and I have a good friend, Tom DeWeese from the American Policy Center. I don't know if you met him when you taught at camp for me. Tom did a recording for us, a video, and actually you did as well. We have Sasha's two classes on the basics of Christian economics, the theory and the practice, available. Contact us here at the Institute for Principled Policy, www.principledpolicy.com, and we can tell you how to get copies of those. But Tom DeWeese did one called Our Emerging Surveillance Society. And this was before all the revelations about drones and those kinds of things came out. And Tom makes exactly the point that you're making, You basically can't do anything without someone looking over your shoulder these days. As a student of history, I've been interested lately in the Tudor period in British history. Just kind of lightly. I'm not getting too far into it. I got other things to do. I got a fish to fry, man. Elder duties keep me busy. My constitution classes keep me busy. But it's interesting to see these kind of things. The British records for that period are massive. And that's because during the Tudor period, it was a police state. Yes. Basically, they were constantly under surveillance. Elizabeth the First had a huge intelligence network. She had a spy master by the name of Walsingham. Okay. And Walsingham had spies every place. And I've been watching some specials where they have these rolled up records. Now, we don't have to do that anymore. You can get the equivalent of that on a now essentially obsolete little tiny microchip that nobody makes them this small anymore.
And if somebody talks about it, if somebody brings it up or, God forbid, publishes it, he's been chased down, all over the world. And, I wonder sometimes if the leaking of all this information that NSA has gathered about us, if the government is really so displeased with it, couldn't it be that the government wants us to know that they're having their eye on us, intimidating us? Because people are basically scared.
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. Okay, Sasha, let me ask you a question. If we're going to go there with it, let's go back to the Bible. Why were, for instance, executions done in public, usually by people who were witnesses at the trial? Now, obviously we don't stone people anymore, but it was done by stoning. Why was it done that way? Well, it seems to me the obvious reason is, first of all, people would say, okay, this is real. It's very hard, A, to be involved in an execution as the executioner or as a witness to the execution without coming away profoundly different in the way you think about it. Executions have usually been done in public up until the 20th century, really, for the simple reason that you wanted people to see the consequences of committing a capital crime. Nowadays, we kind of hide it away in the dark and don't talk about it. I have no problems with making it as painless as possible. Executions aren't supposed to be painful necessarily. They're not supposed to be. They're supposed to send the person back for final judgment to their maker. But we've made it into this. Oh gosh, it's got to be done in private. We don't want to embarrass the family. Actually, unfortunately, we do, and we want to embarrass anyone involved so that they'll get the idea that if you do this same thing, this is the consequence. So we've lost that aspect, I think, of the consequences to actions.
And also, there is no real judiciary anymore, if you think about it. In a society where people can just disappear, in a society where a black limousine can just drive up, the driveway, and with some trumped-up judge, you suddenly disappear and nobody knows where you are. That's not America anymore.
It's not justice, that's for certain. And justice is both a concrete and an abstract. Just to make things as philosophical as possible. And by that I mean justice is something that's actually done that you can put your hands on, but it's also an abstract concept. And the only real definition of justice is in the Bible.
Yeah, and here's the problem. Christians have been very silent. And in the last decades, if you look throughout history, you talked about the Tudors, and you can talk about the Stuarts, you can talk about all the tyranny that has happened in England and in Scotland. Who was always the thorn in the flesh of tyrants? It was always Christians.
Yeah.
Christians who called them to repent, Christians who would call a spade a spade. Now, where is that today? We're facing a church that has become totally complacent and also intimidated. And what you hear, if you want to get people to action, if you want to get Christians to stand up and say enough is enough against unrighteousness, against injustice, you know what they're going to tell you? Politics has nothing to do in the church. And this is the most pathetic of all testimonies in the history of the Church of Jesus Christ.
Well, who was Martin Luther standing before when he said, "Here I stand, I can do no other"?
Yes, Charles V.
Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor,
mm-hmm.
who was not a church official.
No.
He was a state official who was presiding over what amounted to a heresy trial.
Yes, yes, and he couldn't do any other. And sadly, people refer now to Martin Luther to make exactly the case that the worldly realm is totally different from the church. In a certain extent, that is correct. The church is different from the state. But both are under God's law, and the church has the original obligation to call out for justice and to speak out against injustice. And I'm not talking about the so-called social justice irony that we hear from the left, which is basically a perversion of justice. I'm talking about biblical justice, and I'm talking about the church that is utterly asleep. And if we don't wake up, we cannot talk about this country being stolen from us. We can only talk about the country that has been given away by us.
Have you read, there's a book out by Joel McDermott, and it's called God Versus Socialism, that talks about this whole social justice movement, and it's not quite as pointed as, for instance, David Chilton's reply to Ron Sider's Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger,
mm-hmm.
called Rich Christians in an Age of Guilt Manipulators.
Guilt Manipulation, yes.
Basically, we're trying to get McDermott to come on and talk about that book, because I found that book to be very useful.
Yes.
In combating the whole social justice movement, which basically is rife throughout Christianity and has nothing to do with the Christian Bible, except you have groups, you have someone like Tony Campolo who comes out and basically says, "Well, I'm a red letter Christian."
Hmm.
Well, so am I, but here's the problem. They're all red letters.
The whole Bible is red.
That's right. The whole Bible is red letters. And you can't separate out just certain sayings, cut them out of their context, and say, "See, this is what we're going to run our church by."
Exactly. And the danger that comes from Marxism, socialism, communism, Trotskyism, however you want to muddy the waters, it's at the end of the day, it's always the same. It is a philosophy that has declared war on Christianity. It is a philosophy of rebellion. It is the philosophy of the garden. I can be like God. And that's what it is. And I'm not sure if many Christians understand this. I know many are against socialism and Marxism, whatever you want to call it. But at the end of the day, I don't think that many understand the real gravitas of the issue, because it's one thing just to dislike communism because you're an American and Americans always dislike communism. I don't think that's...
Yeah, that's a bad reason to be against something.
Yes, that's no reason at all. But yeah. I think this philosophy is in its origin anti-Christianity. That's why we despise it. That's why we defeat it. That's why we fight against it. It is the devil trying to convince us that man is God and man is represented by the majority through elite in government. And that's opposed to God being God, and we're just exercising his law. So it's if you look at the pillars of socialism, you will see it's basically Ten Commandments upside down.
Well, okay, think about it this way. When Marx wrote that religion is the opiate of the masses, he was just essentially repeating what had been said throughout the Enlightenment, especially the French Enlightenment during the Revolutionary period. And they were just building on people like Descartes. Descartes did not have an evil intent when he came up with his particular philosophy. This is like the old thing that you and I have used, and I've heard you use it, and I know I used it, I think, before I heard you say it. But you're a pilot, so you know it better than I do. When you fly around the world with a compass that's off 1 degree, how far off do you end up when you get back around?
You're nowhere near your destination.
Now, I was thinking about this the other day. You make that same circuit 90 times. Where are you? You're now flying at right angles to where you thought you were going to.
Yes.
If you do it 180 times, you're flying in the opposite direction.
Yes.
So, how's that a problem? Well, we are beginning to see the effects, and we've been off by more than a degree. So you have to make far fewer circuits to get 180 degrees out of line with where you thought you were going.
But there's another problem. It's with our eschatology. You know, in many churches, you hear something preached today that is very pessimistic about the future, and basically what's happening now is a self-fulfilling prophecy. At some point, about 80 years ago in America, people have started to say, okay, Christ is not really on the throne. He's not really ruling history. We're not really waiting for his return into a Christian world. But everything's going down the drains, and there will be persecution. Of course there will be persecution. But at the end of the day, Christ is on the throne, and he's the victor. And if you preach an eschatology, an end times doctrine of defeat and pessimism, you will have results. How people look at the future, that's how they're going to act today. So what has happened? People have retreated from politics. Christians have retreated from all these areas, politics, the judicial system, the top of the business world, because they huddled in the church, if they even did that, and wait for the rapture to happen. While if we really look at Scripture, Christ is on the throne, and he will rule. And we are here, we have a cultural mandate to preach the gospel to all nations, to build a Christian civilization. I mean, if the forefathers, if the founding fathers of this originally great nation would have had the mindset, the eschatological mindset that people have today, there would have been no America. There would have been no Mayflower.
Well, there would have been no point. There was definitely, we will not make the mistake of saying that all the founding fathers, or even a significant portion of them, were completely orthodox in their thought.
Right.
And were absolutely top-notch Christians. They were, in many ways, coasting on the momentum built up by the original founders. And when I say founders, I really mean the Puritans and the Pilgrims.
Yes.
And their offspring. And even though they made major mistakes, really, the Puritan movement was more or less completely different by about the 1660s,
yes,
than it had been when it started in really around when it really got going around the 1630s. In that one short period, things had changed drastically. However, they still had that legacy, and they still had the momentum going, and they still had the post-millennial view.
Yes.
And yes, ladies and gentlemen, if you think we're showing our prejudice regarding our end times eschatological view,
yes, we do.
Are.
Yes, sure.
I'm not ashamed of the fact that I'm a post-millennialist. I'm not an amillennialist. I've had people attempt to switch me over, and I just say, what for? It's bottom line. It's in the Bible. And B, it is an eschatology of defeat. And I'm not interested in defeat. I'm interested in victory. And I'm also aware, as the founding fathers were, that this is a generational covenant. This is not something that you break or fix overnight. This is something that you break or perfect over time. Now, I'm not saying it's ever going to be perfect short of the return of Christ. It's not.
And you might not live to see it. But here's the news, and I love to break it to you. The kingdom is not about you.
That's right.
It's about the king.
Yeah.
So we're not here to be happy. We're not here to have pleasure or joy. Although, we will have lots of pleasure and joy in following our king, because that's what we were made to do.
So, well, we kind of got far off from where we started from. That's fine with me. This is usually what happens with Barry and I. We started out to talk about one thing last week and ended up talking for an hour on something else. And that happens a lot. Because you never know where you're going to be led. And to some extent, we just allow ourselves to be led by events, the Holy Spirit, exactly what we're thinking about a situation. And we just want you to know that Sasha's not all about economics. He is a pastor, Knox Presbyterian Church, Mount Vernon, Ohio. What's your URL on your website?
www.knox-church.org.
Knox-church.org. We'll post a link to it. That being said, we're out of time. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.